Taylor and the worship team, thank you so much. You created a moment for us to really experience what you were trying to say in the words, for the Holy Spirit to be present here, for us to know that, and then for us to exalt him in that. Thank you. That's the heartbeat of what church does. It's a chance for people who want to live their lives following God to be in a place together with like-minded people and then just to know that there is something real in God's presence, and that there, that as much as it's hard to quantify, it's hard to, you can't point at it, you can't say, oh, see, there it is. It's no less real. And that's my prayer each week when I come, whether I'm up here or not, is that we will recognize together the presence of the Holy One. That we will recognize together in our spirits that we actually met God. So thank you, guys. That was awesome. I want to say welcome. I'm glad you're here. Otherwise, I'd be all by myself. But I'm excited that I've had the privilege to be able to share with you guys over the summer months. We're starting a new 4-week series. I just said call it whatever you want, so I made up a title. Water for Life. And I've chosen to touch on 4 stories over the next 4 weeks where water is a key element in the story. And so the other thing I wanted to do is also touch a couple of stories from the Old Testament and a couple of stories from the New Testament. It's easy for us who come to church every week to sort of rest and sit in the New Testament part of the Bible. Because, frankly, that's where we live, right? We're in a space right now where Jesus has already lived, died, rose again from the dead. The death has been conquered. There's a new order around how we relate to God because of Jesus Christ. And so we live in that space now. But you see, the church fathers included the Old Testament because there's good stuff there. And so for those of you who are filling in blanks, I'll try and make sure I get the blanks for you, Rob. Rob's pretty excited. He's got his pen and a hard surface to write on. I know some people are into that. So this week, we're going to be in the Old Testament part of the Bible. That's the first half of the Bible. It's actually, if you didn't know, it's actually all Jewish. It's a Jewish book. So the first 5 books there, the first 5 major divisions in the New Old Testament are called the Pentateuch or the writings of Moses. Our Jewish brothers and sisters would call it the Torah. So that would be the law. So those are the places where they find all of the requirements they needed to do to be right with God. So that's the Old Testament Torah. And then included after the Old Testament, we have essentially 9 historical books. So there's Kings and Chronicles, Joshua. I don't know if you ever tried to memorize the order of the books of the Bible. Some people push back because it seems a little misogynistic to say Joshua, Judges, Ruth. But really, that's just the order of the books. It's not really what happened. There's a lot of years between those. But that's sort of the books that would be in the history part. And then we have the prophets. So when you hear in the New Testament the religious leaders talking about the law and the prophets, this is what they're talking about. The law, the first 5 books of Moses, and then the prophets. And they sort of lumped in those historical pieces with the law and the prophets. It's sort of some of the people like Samuel is a historical book, but Samuel was a prophet. So that's sort of where that heading comes from when you hear that phrase being used in the New Testament. But the fact of the matter is, the Old Testament, here's a blank for you, get your pen ready. I'm watching Rob, he was engaged. I captured his attention, that's awesome. So the Old Testament is an echo of the New Testament. The Old Testament is an echo of the New Testament. And I put it that way intentionally because in spite of the fact that the New Testament happened after, so you can't have a reverse echo, but the whole book of the Bible, if you spend time reading the Bible regularly, and I would encourage you to do that, but as you do, when you read the Old Testament next time, look for familiar themes that you remember from the New Testament. So there are a lot of echoes that you'll hear. So, and I say it that way because we spend a lot of our time in the New Testament, but when you read the Old Testament, there are a lot of things that seem to be reflected in the New Testament that are in the Old Testament. There's a unity that happens there. Not every story, but often. And it's not maybe something even specific. It might be a principle that you draw out from when you're reading in the Old Testament. Go, I remember that from the New Testament. And it happens both ways. One of my favorite courses in Bible school was called Bible Synthesis. You see, the Bible was written, the time span from the writing Moses did from the beginning where Genesis is to where John wrote in the Isle of Patmos, the things of Revelation, the end time things. That's about 1,500 years span. For me, when I hear these echoes between these two sections of the book, this 1,500-year span, all of a sudden I realize that there was an intelligence behind the creation of what we call the Bible. That there's a unifying authorship there, even though it is multiple authors over a huge amount of time. God has woven a thread theme through that whole piece. And I would suggest that the theme that we see through the whole Bible is pointing to Jesus. The Old Testament, the things that God had instituted for Israel to do so that they would be right with him were things that Jesus accomplished in the New Testament. These are the echoes, the shedding of blood for sin. Jesus accomplishes in the New Testament. These things happen. So I'd encourage you to engage yourself in some of that investigation when you read your Bible every day, like I know everyone does. Not even me. So before we read this portion of the Bible we're in today, I want to give a little bit of background quickly. And you'll see in your notes, I want to reverse. So the second line there is God's rescue of Israel from slavery of Egypt. But I mixed it up. I had to send this to the office to print, and then I had to write it down in my thoughts, and I had them all mixed up. So I apologize. So if I miss one, wave at me, and I'll fill it in for you. But before we read this portion, I want to set the stage a little bit. Israel is in Egypt. So the reason they're there is because of Joseph and his amazing Technicolor dream coat. So I don't know if you're familiar with that Broadway show, but Joseph's amazing Technicolor dream coat is the reason why Israel's in Egypt. There was a famine. Joseph's story, you may have been familiar, you may not, it's okay, go see the show. But Joseph brought his whole family, his dad and all his brothers, eventually emigrated to Egypt. And they are living in Egypt now. And they go through that whole story, the famine and of being in Egypt. And from that point to this point, there's been about 220 plus years. So the nation of Israel has multiplied and grown in the area of Egypt that they were given. And so there's been several government changes in Egypt, and there's a new government change, and the government of Egypt decides that there's way too many foreigners. Let's make them work. And so they end up enslaving Israel, all of the Hebrew people, all of the Jewish people in Egypt, and forcing them to labor. So then We're not sure specifically if they're the guys that built the pyramids or who all was doing all of that over there. But Israel was forced labor for Egypt at the point where this begins to happen. And what happens is, this is the third one out in the background, so I kind of got it mixed up. But God chose Moses to be his spokesperson to Israel. You see, the Bible talks about, I've mentioned earlier, the law and the prophets, right? A prophet really is, in fact, a spokesperson for God to a group of people. So Moses was God's spokesperson to Israel. He was the one who was going to come to Israel and help them. So he arrives on the scene. This is another probably relatively current movie, The Prince of Egypt. Isn't it horrible that you're using media like that to reference for people to frame what's going on in the Bible? But it's true. The Prince of Egypt, Moses was a prince in Egypt, and Moses was the guy, and some of us who are older would remember, you know, Charlton Heston standing in the top of a rock with the wind blowing in his hair and a staff and you know, those images. That's the story where we are right now. Moses rescuing Israel from slavery in Egypt. So that's what's the background going on, and I'm sure that we're familiar with some of those things. And so they leave Egypt, and I want to show you a map. This is sort of the red line is sort of the route they took. Those yellow triangles, I don't know if you can see them too well. There's lots of them there. The reason that they're there is because several dozen scholars have tried to pinpoint which mountain is actually Sinai, where the Ten Commandments were given. And we're not sure exactly historically, so this particular guy wrote, here's where everybody thinks those Mount Sinai happened. But you'll see down in the bottom there is, just at the end of the Red Trail, I don't know if you can read it, it says Rephidim. That's a place where the people were complaining and thirsty and all that stuff. And then you go up in the wilderness of Paran as you're reading your wilderness of Zin. And at the top you'll see just the beginning of the green line, it says Kadesh Barnea. That's sort of near the end of the 40 years of wandering around that whole peninsula there. I don't know how much you've seen in the news or in any kind of current events that region. It's quite arid and dry. But one of the things that stands out is that these rescued slaves had a really difficult time coping with this newfound freedom. They don't quite know what to do with this God who shakes mountains, who leads them during the day by this cloud that seems to move with some sort of directional intelligence, or at night this column of fire suspended in the sky, and these people have spent 200 plus years in Egypt, where their reference point for any deity was the Egyptian pantheon of gods. And so they've got no frame of reference for this being who is pursuing them, who actually gave them a rescuer in Moses, who communicates directly with Moses. And when he does, the whole ground vibrates. And there's these miraculous things, the water parting. They are freaked out. They don't know what to make of it because they have no frame of reference. And it's important for us to recognize that, because sometimes we get judging a little harsh on those Israelites. Oh, they're complaining. Oh, they're this. Oh, they're that, as we read these stories. But you have to remember how many of us would sort of fall in that category, because we're not used to engaging a God we can't see or touch or hear or feel. All the Egyptian gods had a statue, had a shape, had something reference point. This God was a cloud, kind of, at the daytime, and fire at night. How do you associate with that? It's dangerous. And so the first five books that Moses writes, Israel regularly complains, regularly disobeys. For Moses, it's almost too much. It's not like he asked for this position. But I want you to recognize that there is this being, the Most High God, who is wanting to connect with you. who is wanting to be somehow related with you. And yeah, there's terms to that relationship. There's a reality around what that looks like. But he's pursuing. You see, all along, God's intention was that Israel was good. This is the third one down. That's why I mixed it up. Israel was to be an example to the rest of the world of what a group of people who love and trust and follow God look like. Israel was going to be sort of the megaphone. There's a diagram I drew. So we've got God's message, and we've got this nation of Israel, and they're going to live in obedience and trust and love with this hard-to-describe being. And as they do that in trust and obedience and love, it will be a proclamation to the rest of the world of what that can look like. There's descriptions God gives to these people. If you obey, then all of these amazing things will happen. If you just love me, if you obey what I ask, then this will happen. You will be amazingly blessed. All of your crops will just overflow with abundance. Your families will last. Your dynasty will grow. If you don't obey, there's consequences. And so your crops will be really small and shriveled, and your dynasties will be short and small. And I don't want that for you. But history tells us that even though God's desire was for that kind of relationship, Israel had a hard time doing it. So we're going to look today at an instance through that journey with Israel trying to figure this out with God. This relationship with God that is regularly on again, off again. And it's not on again, off again because of God. It's on and off again because of the people of Israel. And I was drawn to this because it was such an interesting echo of my own life. Of our experience on again, off again with God, isn't it? Sometimes we're on fire. This morning when that sense that God's Spirit was indeed present here. And then tomorrow we're frustrated and the highway to work or left lane is jam-packed. Nobody's passing. It's just a gong show, and the furthest thing from my thinking is this thing about God. He didn't turn anything off in that relationship. It was all me. And so it is with Israel. So I want you to kind of, with those things in mind, I want you to be thinking of a time, maybe in the last week or in recent history, where you were like completely frustrated. Maybe it was your kids. Maybe your kids just, you've said it 100,000 times, put it away. It's not hard. It's 2 feet from the top of the counter to the dishwasher. Right? I know the shower was great, but you need to leave your laundry there. Maybe it's not your kids. Maybe you're a kid and you're like, oh, come on, Dad, really? Yeah, again? Do you have to embarrass me? How many times do we talk about this at home and just, Dad, leave me out of it? Whatever it is, whatever point, I want you to remember what that frustration felt like, because we're going to enter a story this morning where you'll be able to identify a bit with that. So I want you to turn in your Bible. We're going to be in a book called Numbers. It's one of the five books of the Bible, Numbers chapter 20, verses 1 to 3. The reference is at the top of the insert. Numbers 20, verses 1 to 13. Verse 1 says, in the first month of the year, the whole community of Israel arrived in the wilderness of Zin and camped at Kadesh, where they were. While they were there, Miriam died and was buried. So this is that part in the map that I showed you up at the top where Kadesh Barnea was. There was a big heading there, wilderness of Zin. I love those. They're kind of like, you know, it reminds me of a genie in a bottle when I see those names, Prandaran and Zin, and then there's the wilderness of, you kind of feel like Arabian Nights. But this is where they are, at the top of that map, Kadesh Barnea, and they're there. It's like they've been there before because God has had them wandering around that peninsula for about 40 years, and they're coming close to the end of this time. Verse 2, there was no water for the people to drink at that place, so they rebelled against Moses and Aaron. The people blamed Moses and said, "Huh, if only we had died in the Lord's presence with our brothers. Why have you brought us and this whole congregation to the Lord's people into this wilderness to die along with all of our livestock? Why did you make us leave Egypt and bring us here to this terrible place? This land is no grain, no figs, no grapes, no pomegranates, no water to drink, no red bull, no great-looking things to sit under the shade. It's just horrible." Verse 6. I added the red bull part, if you ever noticed. Verse 6. Moses and Aaron turned away from the people and went to the entrance of the tabernacle. The tabernacle was a portable church that Israel had with them as they wandered, where they fell face down on the ground. Then the glorious presence of the Lord appeared to them. That was a deeper moment than what we experienced this morning. That was a more real moment. And the Lord said to Moses, "You and Aaron must take the staff and assemble the entire community. As the people watch, speak to the rock over there, and it will pour out its water, and you will provide enough water from the rock to satisfy the whole community and their livestock." What were the instructions? Speak to the rock, and what's going to happen to the rock? Water's coming out of a rock. That's a pretty neat trick. But you got to remember, when the people are grumbling and complaining like this, the reason Moses and Aaron right away go to the tabernacle is because a couple of chapters before, when they're complaining, God's like, "Okay, I'm done. I am completely done. Let's just kill them all. I am so done. Let's wipe them out." And Moses and Aaron say, "No, no, please no." And they plead for Israel. And then here, the people are complaining again, and guess what Moses and Aaron are thinking? "Oh, great. We can't have that. That's not the God that we know. We're frustrated too, but he's got a lot of power. He parted the Red Sea. Back at Rephidim, the bottom of the map that you were looking at, there was another time. And they were thirsty and complaining that they were thirsty, and God told Moses, "Take that rod that you had and you stood out over the ocean or the Red Sea and it parted. Take that, and I want you to hit that rock twice and water's going to come out." And that's what happened. So it's not something that's unusual for Israel that God would provide when they're thirsty. For the whole 38 years they've been wandering in the wilderness, what have they been eating? White stuff that show up on the ground in the morning. You might have heard the word manna. Have you heard that word before? This means yes, this means no. Okay, cool. So, do you know what manna means? It's a Hebrew word that says, "What is it?" Because they got up one morning hungry and went out and looked in the ground. There's this stuff on the ground. And Moses says, "Collect it. You can use it and make it and eat it into like loaves and stuff." And the people are like, "Oh, what is it? Oh, it's good." So they collected, what is it, for like 38 years across the Sinai Peninsula. So it's not unusual for God to provide. And here they stand, thirsty and complaining and upset because, oh, Israel's got grapes and figs and pomegranates. Look at us. We got nothing. Sweet diddly. And so Moses and Aaron are at the tabernacle. They're at the tent of meeting with the Most High God. And they're saying, "Okay, God, what do you want us to do?" God says, "I want you to stand up, and I want you to take that rod that you have, and I want you to go over to the rock over there. I want you to just speak to it, and water will come out. What did I tell you happened the first time when they met a rock that was sort of pregnant with water? He had to hit it, right? Hit it twice and water come out. This time, what are the instructions? Just speak to it. Something happens when we are engaged in a relationship with God and there's something miraculous that happens. We remember it like it was yesterday and we remember it forever. I remember sitting in a church and knowing in my heart I had to go with a music team that was visiting. And I remember arguing with that feeling, and my dull brain recognized at some point that might have been a conversation with God. And I remember making this deal. God, you make it happen because I'm going home right away when this is over. And no sooner does the service the prayer isn't even done. The pastor's praying, and my youth pastor goes like this on my shoulder and walks me up to this group, and da-da-da-da-da, I end up traveling to Switzerland and Europe and Germany and Holland and playing saxophone. God put it all together. I was there. I remember it. And so it is with Moses at this moment, taking the staff. He remembers water came out of that rock. These people are getting on my nerves. I am the frustration of 38 years of complaining and asking to go back to slavery. Verse 9, chapter 20. So Moses did as he was told. He took the staff from the place where it was kept before the Lord. He and Aaron summoned the people to come together at the rock. They're all there. Can you hear the frustration in the next section? Listen, you rebels, he shouted. Must we bring water from this rock? Moses raised his hand and he struck twice with the staff and water gushed out. It's only a few words, but I want you to catch it. So the entire community and their livestock drank their fill. We're talking approximately over, at this point, scholars are divided on how many people, but over a million is what the sense is. Lots. And their livestock drank their fill from a rock. Massive miracle from God Most High. But look at verse 12. The Lord said to Moses and Aaron, because you didn't trust me enough to demonstrate my holiness to the people of Israel, you won't be the ones to lead them into the land I'm giving them. This place was known as the waters of Meribah, which means arguing, because there the people of Israel argued with the Lord, and he demonstrated his holiness among them. Israel got what they needed, but Moses was totally frustrated, and understandably so. Three takeaways this morning I want to leave you with. Number one, don't let your anger get the better of you. Moses loses it. It's understandable, all things considered. Nobody would fault him. Most of us in that same situation likely would have done the same thing. The people he's leading are complaining again and again and again. And yet, they've seen enough to convince them that this real God, this Most High God, does have real power. But they lose sight of that and point at Moses and blame and complain and point their finger at him. Why did you do this? He's the problem. So it's not a surprise to me Moses, in his frustration, hits the rock. But he saw God do it when he hit the rock before at Rephidim. But in his anger, he struck that rock. In his anger, he said, look, we are going to do this. As if the people were going to say, yeah, see, Moses made water come from the rock. Rather than Moses going, God's going to do this, and I'm just going to talk to the rock, and God will make the water come out. But you see what anger does? It clouds our judgment. It makes us miss it. God did not say, hit the rock. But in his anger, he didn't obey God, what God had said. And that leads me to the second point. A relationship with God includes trust and obedience. A relationship with God includes trust and obedience. I think sometimes we encounter things in our lives and we imagine that we have to endure them on our own. It's so easy for us to be used to using these five senses we have that we miss that there is this Almighty God who is right there, right here, right in this moment with you, with me. He's not a God far away, up in the clouds, on a big stone chair with a Louisville slugger, just waiting to bean you on the head because you did something wrong. That's not the God that we have. And I know it's hard because we can't see him. We can't truly experience this God with our five senses. But my friends, I know he is always, always right here. But that confidence can only come by trust and obedience. And we need to encourage each other with our own personal stories of God's faithfulness. There have been times that each of us have seen God's faithfulness in our life. There have been moments that we can point to. We need to be sharing these stories with each other. Because I'm not always going to be, oh, the talker guy at the front of the church who's got Bible stuff going on. I'll need to hear your stories of God's faithfulness to encourage me to remember to trust and obey. You're going to need to hear my stories. I remember sitting in my bedroom office section, looking at my bank account going, God, I just got let go from a job. I've got to pay the mortgage next Tuesday. I'm not sure how that's going to happen. I got it. What am I going to, like, and God whispers to my heart, do you trust me? And I've been a pastor. And I'll, yeah, of course. I'm in ministry. Come on. But he says it again. Do you really trust me? Mostly. But that mortgage payment's coming out Tuesday. I mean, you're great, and I love you, and I understand this relationship, but the bank doesn't. Do you trust me? From that time, it seems like everywhere I turn, every circumstance I encounter, there's that whisper. Do you trust me? Are you willing to trust me? Because you see, God longs for that relationship to happen between us. Trust and obey, because there is no other way to be happy, to truly be happy in Jesus, but to trust and obey. And finally, a reminder, my friends, we live in a battle zone. You see, Jesus conquered death and the grave. The war's been won at the cross. But here and now, it's as if we live in a battle zone with our enemy still trying to fight for land. It's like our enemy is this resistance that's happening, and there's these skirmishes going on. And we're walking with Jesus. We still see the effects that the war has had, the devastation it brings. And to make things more complicated, God's kingdom allows moral agents to have a choice. You see, there are moral agents in the spiritual realm who oppose God's authority. There are moral agents around us. You and I are moral agents, able to choose right or wrong. There are moral agents around us who affect all of the circumstances that we encounter. And we have no control over those things. It's a battle zone. The war's won. But we're in a battle zone. Creation itself is reeling from the effects of the war. So unfortunately, lastly this morning, there are consequences. But consequences do not mean God is against you or doesn't love you. I'm going to say that again. Consequences do not mean that God is against you or doesn't love you. In spite of how it feels, in spite of the well-meaning friends who say, oh, God's trying to teach you a lesson, but God's not against you. That difficulty, that trial you're facing is not God on that stone throne wagging his finger at you, saying, oh, ho, ho, and causing some calamity. No. Some consequences are the result of our choices. Some trials and difficulties happen that we have no control over. Children drown. There was a news story this morning I heard on the news, 3-year-old kid playing. They couldn't find him. It was like 48 hours searching for this kid. They found him 40 meters from his house, face down in a water-filled ditch. That's not God, my friends. God did not make that happen. It's not God trying to help us be more holy by putting us through this grinder. I don't believe that God is punishing us. And the reason is, the punishment has already been meted out. The punishment happened at Calvary. Jesus endured an execution that paid for sin. That's where the war ended. That's where the war finished, because Jesus paid it there. He took it for me. What we're left to do is to live for him here and now in this broken world, doing our very best to actively live and do the things that Jesus would do. You see, the name that you are called Christian, do you know what that is? Little Jesus. A big excuse that I had and I've heard is, well, I could never forgive that person. I'm not God. I'm not Jesus. I can't do, or whatever the blank is at the end of that. But the actual name Christian means you are a little Jesus. You are operating here and now in this broken world as if Jesus were physically possessing your hands and your feet and making them go and do things you normally wouldn't. And it's not a weird, spooky possession thing like the media has in the movies. No. No, this is where you're in control of your faculties and you're like, God, you're making me want to. I'm becoming more like Jesus. That's the idea. In spite of Moses not quite obeying God here, in spite of the people complaining about God not looking after them, God in his mercy still gave them water. And not just a little trickled ration to quench their thirst, but overflowing so that they got their fill. It gushed out of the rock, the text says. Dear friends, we serve a generous God, not a stingy one. And even though Moses disobeyed these instructions, even though he seemed to that he would make water out, still God provided more than what was expected. That's the God we worship. That's the God that was reflected in Jesus Christ that we see when we were talking about the fellowship of the mat. That's the generosity that we see. Perhaps God is more like the long-suffering parent who, in spite of the many times that we've let our parent down, still demonstrate his love for us, no matter what. That's what parents do. Yeah, your kids are going to frustrate you. Things are going to happen. But you love them. You do that. One of the songs on my iPod has these words. Now remember when I told you this was the last you'll see of me? Sort of like a repentant child to his parent. Now remember when I told you that's the last you'll see of me? Remember when I broke you down to tears? I know I took the path that you would never want for me. I gave you problems through all the years. But I bet my life. I bet my life on you. So I want you to know this morning as I finish. God is worth trusting and obeying. He is worth trusting and obeying. I encourage you to do that. In fact, I bet my life on it. I bet my life that that's worth it. Let's pray.